That's all right. You can take it away. Thank you. Go ahead. This interview is for the Veterans History Project and is with Charles Francis Bruns, Sr. of Champaign, Illinois. During the years 1942 to 1945, he served as an Army combat engineer in North Africa, Sicily, Italy, France, and Germany. Mr. Bruns, thank you so much for being here today. Today is Monday, September 24th, 2007. My name is Harriet Williamson. Also present is the lighting, sound, and camera director, Henry Radcliffe. We are in the television studio of WILL on the University of Illinois campus in Urbana. Prior to joining the military, what were you doing?
I was working with the Joe LeCunin Company. I was a sales clerk there before I went into service then.
Would you like to talk about your background, where you were born, and your date?
Well, the only thing I can tell you about my background was that I was born at Villa Grove, Illinois, April 27th, 1919. And as far as I know from my mother, I was born in a house, and that was it. I wasn't born in a hospital. So, but from there, I think that they told me at the age of two we moved to Champaign then. So, and my father was a tailor at Joseph Coonan Company.
Mm-hmm. And did you have any siblings?
Yes, I have two sons. One son, Charles, just like me, Charles F. Bruns, Jr., and John F. Bruns. Charles lives in Champaign, and John is a farmer up at Cisna Park.
Do you also have any brothers or sisters?
Yes, I have. I had two sisters and a brother, and I have one brother that's both my brother and my sister is dead, and my other sister lives in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and she's 95. So, and I'll see her in a few more weeks.
Now, did you go to elementary and junior high school and high school?
Yes, I went to elementary school. I went to Holy Cross School for elementary school and Champaign Senior High, for senior. And then out of there, in other words, the war came along at that time, and I was working at Coons then, and I was drafted, and to get my draft over with, I decided to volunteer to get my year over with so I could come back home, I didn't quite make it. Okay. And I noticed you said it was from 42, it was from 41.
Right. I'm sorry. I should correct that. What I meant was you saw combat from
42
to 45.
Oh, my combat was started.
But you definitely, 1941 was when you entered the service, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. So you joined the Army.
Yes, at Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri. I went to Fort Sheridan, Illinois, and a funny thing happened. Celia Johnson he did a lot of work for Chinook Field, and he knew the general real well, and I was a ball player at that time. So they decided this general was going to get me on the ball team out in Mather Field, California, which was an air base. Mm-hmm. So when I got to Fort Sheridan, that's where I was supposed to go. Well, I guess I was either gone when they called my name to go, and I wasn't around, and they said, well, I have to wait a while, and they'll call it again. Well, then, in the meantime, they called it to go to Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri. Well, that was closer to home, so I thought, well, shoot, I'll take the place closer to home. And I didn't realize what I was getting into when I went there.
Well, why don't you talk about that?
Well, what do you want me to say, honey?
What did Fort Leonard Wood look like at that point in time?
Well,
established?
When I went into Fort Leonard Wood, there was only just a very few barracks, hardly any roads at all. All we really had was we had a movie house, we had a PX, and maybe half a dozen, maybe a dozen of barracks. And they were working on them all at that same time. In fact, that's where I took a lot of my training was working on roads, getting everything set up for when they were going to move in there.
Now, was your initial training and is the how? Let me start again. Were there several battalions based there, or would it just be one?
Gee, to be honest with you, I don't know. There was a lot of troops in there, but I mean, like our platoon, I think there must have been at least, I would say, 50 to 75 in our platoon.
Okay.
Anyhow, because I mean, for your basic training,
mm-hmm.
and each group was set up. I don't know how to say this. I mean that for your initial engineer training. In other words, that your engineer training was, in other words, learning how to set a barbed wire fence.
Okay.
See, digging trenches. They were going back. They were teaching us things that happened in World War I, mm-hmm. which was. No need to try to teach us to do things like that, but this is what they taught us.
So you feel that training was not relevant to what you were going to face?
Not after we got into combat. It had nothing to really to... Well, it was training, all right, but it had nothing... The only really training that you had was shooting a gun and how to handle explosives, because we did a lot of, you know, and also... clearing mines. You had to do a lot of, I mean, we learned to do that. And I can remember that one of our training schedules, that we had to handle dynamite. And dynamite is very, very sensitive. And it just so happened that the officer pulled out this one stick of dynamite and said, now this is how it can be. And he threw the dynamite out and bingo, it went off. Now that's how sensitive that, you know, the dynamite.
Mm-hmm.
Well, after that, before we left there, we were using TNT then, which was real safe as you can find, yeah.
Okay, I didn't realize there was a difference. So there's a difference.
Oh, there's all the difference in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Dynamite is very, very sensitive. I mean, if it's too old or if it's set around too long, the...
Mm-hmm.
It would drain to one side. In other words, it very, very. But the TNT was, there's no way in God's world you could set that off unless you set it off with a cap and a primer cord. It was just like an explosive then.
Okay. So were you also taught to use various kinds of equipment, like road digging equipment or anything?
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, we had mainly, just like I say, it was just plain old road digging, and we also had pontoon training too at the same time. I showed us, you know, how we built all bridges across the river down in Missouri, and we had to build, you know, like pontoon boats across, but nothing compared to what we did once we got into training in the after we went to Fort Lewis, Washington then.
Now, can you talk a little bit about the pontoon bridges? What is a pontoon bridge? What are they made out?
The pontoon bridge is nothing but you have a huge boat, rubber boat across,
mm-hmm.
and naturally it floats in the river, and then you have a runway, you know, more or less just for the mm-hmm. trucks and cars to go across, and most generally small pontoon boats are only for like jeeps and small cars. Later on I'll tell you about, we built a bridge when we were at Fort Lewis, Washington, and we sent a 2.5-ton truck across. It got too far on one side and bingo, upset into the water. So, I mean, it's the pontoon bridge, unless you have one that is really anchored with steel pilings and footings going across, they're really dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
It's mainly to getting the troops across.
Okay.
Is what they're mainly for, was that we built that across so that they could, you know, run across the on the pontoon bridge.
Could you have a deep body of water and use a pontoon bridge, or does it have to be just shallow?
It doesn't have to be deep, but most generally rivers are, you know, it all depends on how wide the river is,
mm-hmm.
too. I mean, now throwing one across the Mississippi River, you couldn't do that. It's
mm-hmm.
too wide. But across a small river, you have to anchor them and, you know, and make sure that they're secure and they're not going to go anyplace. And the pontoons are quite large, and you can also put your piling across there and your bridge work, and they'd be very secure. I mean, you could, but it, like I said, it's mainly for small vehicles and mainly to get the troops across the river.
You also had some basic combat training when you were at Fort Leonard Wood, is that
correct? It was very little combat training what we had there. I mean, we had you learned to, back in those days we only had Springfield rifles. And you'd go out on the range and shoot and qualify for handling a gun and everything. Mm-hmm. And but as far as I would say combat, I really and truly can't remember anything that we did in Fort Leonard Wood for training other than more or less doing engineer work. Mm-hmm. Is mainly what it was for.
So the expectation was that you would be an engineer and you would not necessarily be fighting.
Well, it all depends. There are different phases of engineers. I mean, in other words, now, when I went to Fort Lewis, Washington, that this was a combat engineer outfit there, which was, we were attached to the 7th Infantry.
Okay.
And all of our work there was strictly for the whatever the infantry did. This is what we had to do. It was not for the rest of the division, or unless we had to run into a large job where they took more, of our whole battalion to put a bridge across, and it was altogether different. But, I mean, as far as what I learned in Fort Leonard Wood, it was nothing compared to the training we got once we got to Fort Lewis, Washington.
Okay.
And got into regular Army training, what you'd call. I mean, I think it was just more or less at Fort Leonard Wood, it was kind of an introductory service to get you in practice, because, we had hikes and different things like that, but it was nothing compared to once I got to Fort Lewis.
Well, let me stop for just a second and maybe get some dates. So when you entered the military, what was the date of your...
May of 41.
41, okay. And the war had, for the U.S. had not actually started, had it, in May 41?
I was at Fort Leonard Wood about, I can't remember, whether it was 1 or 2 months that we were there for training. And then we went to Fort Lewis, Washington.
Okay.
And then our training there from... The time I think it was we got out in Fort Lewis, Washington around August sometime, because in other words, the war broke out in December 8th of that year of 41.
Mm-hmm. Now going back to Fort Lewis, Washington, do you want to talk about the type of training that you received there, which was...
Well, there is very intensive training. I mean, we had a lot you had a lot of drilling to do. Mainly was amphibious work. Mm-hmm. Where we had to, every morning we were up before daylight, when we'd be out on the Puget Sound, and we'd have to get into these Higgins boats, which were not very big. I mean, you had about maybe 15 to 18 men in a boat, and you'd go across the sound, and get out of your boat like you say you're going on an invasion or something like that. And also, they were back to the building pontoon bridges across the sound, and everything. I mean, it was really more engineer, really. I mean, it showed you how to clear mines, to build, do different things that you were really going to use during the service. Mm-hmm. But it was nothing. Excuse me. It was nothing compared to once we got into combat. Altogether different. Everything changed. Everything that we learned when we got into combat changed. Okay. It's hard to say. We evenly, all of our sergeants, and there was a turnover in sergeants on account of, most all of them were in the service long before we got there, and they were old drill sergeants, and they did this and that, but when we got into combat, they weren't any good at all. So, I mean, in other words, they either got demoted or new sergeants placed in there, you know.
So do you feel that training was really a benefit when you got into combat?
Oh, sure. Heck, yes. I mean, it made all the difference in the world. I mean, you knew what you were going to do then, and, mm-hmm. and it also... The officers made a big... You had good officers and you had bad officers. I mean, I had a lot of officers from here, from the U of I, that some of them were good and some of them weren't good. We mm-hmm. call them 90-day wonders, so... Excuse me.
After you left Fort Lewis, you spent some time in California.
Well, from when I was at Fort Lewis, they took about 50 of us, and from different, like so many from A, I was in A Company. They took so many from A Company, so many from B Company, and so many from C Company. And we went with the Navy then. We were with the Navy about, 4 months. And we went from Tacoma, Washington, up through Alaska, and I'll never forget that. The waves were so big, you know, that you'd come way up like that, you wouldn't see anybody, and then you'd be clear down here, and I got sick. I was so sick for 3 days, and the sailors kept saying, eat something, and I'd eat something, and bingo, up would come, just like, but once I got over, I was never seasick again. I mean, even like when we went overseas, the soldiers just got sicker than the devil. Never bothered me a bit, so... But I mean, once I got by that part, it was okay. But we lived with I lived with the Navy there for about 4 months when we got down to San Diego, and we were taking our training with the 1st, 2nd, and 3rd Marines because we were going to the South Pacific. Doggone it, sorry about that. But anyhow, while we were there, we stayed on the ship. And of course, we had the soldiers, they were eating sea rations. Here we were eating food that the Navy had provided, and we'd go in at town at night. They couldn't do anything. So it was quite, I really enjoyed I wish I was back in the Navy again.
Now that training, what was the idea of that training with the Navy?
Ma'am?
What was it?
We had operated the boons and stuff to put the boats over the side and down into the water, and he also had the big cable nets that you put over the side for the soldiers to crawl down the side of the boat and get into the Higgins boat, see? Mm-hmm. Once they crawled down in and got into the Higgins boat, then they'd go out and they'd make a circle around and around, and you had to keep going until all the boats were filled, you know, with soldiers and launched, and then they'd line up, and then bingo, they would head toward the beach uh-huh. then. But they practice that and practice that and practice that because it made all the difference in the world. Once it, you got everything, you had to keep going around till the next boat fill in, and you'd keep going, another boat would fill in, see, till everybody was there. And then once it was all there, the commander would make a motion like that, and bingo, they'd all spread out, and then they'd all mm-hmm. head toward shore.
Mm-hmm. Now, after you finished that training, what was your next camp? Did you continue in California?
Well, no. Like I said, we were at Camp Pendleton. We were taking all this different training there at mm-hmm. Camp Pendleton, different marches. You had a lot of marching. But anyway, it was more or less just to build up your strength and everything. And anyhow, then a third of the division come down with yellow jaundice. And when they were all sick, couldn't go, and then back in those days, it took a long time for a person to get over mm-hmm. Jaundice. So in other words, they just scrapped the whole thing and they sent us back to Fort Ord then. Then we went back there and we were more or less just doing different training, like clearing minefields or just odds and ends, really, until we got ready to go, because there was not many things that we could do. Also, engineers, we had water, where we set up different camps to make. We had a huge tank that we'd use for water, and we'd learn how to filter out the water, make the water clear and everything. Mm-hmm. And we'd go on different, they'd take us out to different small towns where we had set these things all up so that we'd have something to, you know, to go along to. Because they even sent us one time to San Francisco. We went on a, you know, all the way up there, and we mm-hmm. set up water tanks all around different, you know, it was just moving and setting them up, moving and setting them up. So that's about really the only thing that was bad about, well, it wasn't bad, but I mean, we didn't really have what you call amphibious training then, too. Mm-hmm. So the amphibious training was more or less kind of over once we left Camp mm-hmm. Pendleton. Cause
did you feel like you were kind of at loose ends? Did you know where you were going?
Ma'am?
Did you know where you were going?
No, no. When we left Fort Leonard Wood, nobody knew where they were going. I mean, they just loaded us on the train, and in fact, we didn't know where we were going till we got close to somebody. How it got out, but somebody said we were going to Camp Pickett, Virginia, mm-hmm. and then when we got there, why we started our training again of amphibious training, and then. We loaded the ships, and when we loaded the ships there, why, we had what you'd call Bangalore torpedoes. They're a pipe, it's about that big around, and they're about 8 to 10 feet long. And each one screwed into another pipe, and you'd run those underneath the barbed wire and explode them, and that would blow a hole through the barbed wire entanglement so that you could get through there. And when we were getting ready to get on the ship, the stevedores refused to handle the Bangalore torpedoes because they thought that they were explosives and they couldn't do it. Mm-hmm. So we had to load our own Bangalore torpedoes onto the ship. It took quite a while to get everything on that ship, and everybody had to do it because the stevedores just, they wouldn't do it.
So you went from Fort Ord then
to Camp Pickett, Virginia, mm-hmm. yeah.
Now, mm-hmm. is Camp Pickett on the coast or is it inland?
Well, it's down near Newport News.
Okay.
That's where we left from. We left mm-hmm. from Newport News when we went overseas to Africa then.
Now, when you were there, did you know where you were headed at that point in time?
Nope. Nobody knew where we were going or anything. I mean, until after we were out to sea for, you know, quite some time. And mm-hmm. then somebody said we were going to Africa. And we didn't really know then where we were going to, but we were going to Fedela, North Africa, which mm-hmm. was about 20 miles from Casablanca. Now, the other troops that were going there, they were, landed way up in Tunis or someplace in the northern part of Africa, mm-hmm. and we landed in the southern part.
Were you in a big convoy when you were traveling to Africa then, or were they just...
Yeah, we were, the whole division, whenever the division moved, it would all go by convoy. Each outfit, like the infantry would move, and then the artillery would move, and then the engineers would move, or vice versa. You never know which one was going to, whichever one was ready to go out, why then you'd take off, and they already knew where the bivouac areas were, and where you were going to set up ahead of time. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you didn't have to worry about anything like that, because everything was all really taken care of before you ever got there, because we went from... we went from there clear up to, from Casablanca clear to Bizerte, which is clear up on the upper part of the coast, and because Rommel and all the British were still fighting in Africa at that time, because at one time there they took part of our sergeants, and we had to go up and see, you know, they took us up to see what's going on at the Kasserine Pass on account of that was really one of the disasters of the army there was at Kasserine Pass.
Would you like to talk about that?
Well, I wasn't there that long to really talk about it because, I mean, I don't know a whole lot about it. I mean, I wasn't in the battle or anything like that, but I do know that we lost a lot of men, a lot of tanks that the Germans caught us before we could get set for it, and that's when Patton came in. Patton came in, and he changed the whole thing around, and then we started pushing the Germans completely out of Africa at that time.
Mm-hmm. I would like for you to talk about North Africa some more, but before we do that, we should probably identify your rank and the division, that you were
well,
in.
Well, I was a sergeant. I was in the 10th Combat Engineers, and we were attached to the 3rd Infantry Division. Mm-hmm. So in other words, I was in the 3rd Infantry Division, you might well say, but we were attached to the 7th Infantry Regiment. Now, the divisions have like 3 regiments. They have the 7th, which we were A Company was attached to. They had the 15th Infantry, which the B Company was attached to. And we also had the 30th Infantry, which a C Company was attached to. Then we had our headquarters company, and the headquarters company supplies us with all of our material, any material that we needed. But this Audie Murphy, who is the most decorated serviceman in the United States Army, he was in the 15th Infantry. And I had seen, you know, sometimes we had to work with the 15th Infantry at different times, you know, that if we had to, more men had to be used to clean the minefields or something like that. Mm-hmm. So, but he was a little guy. I can't believe that how big he was. I mean, the size of him but he was something else. That was all there was to it. And also, James Arness, who was from Gunsmoke, was in our 30th. I never did see him, but I mean, he was in our 30th Infantry too. So we had some famous men in our division. So
I would like to stop for a second and talk about your photography during the war. Last evening, you allowed me to look through your 4 albums. And they are truly amazing documentation of your service. And it looks like you started taking photographs when you went to Fort Leonard Wood. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I had that camera went with me all through service. I mean, it was just a little tiny old thing, and it was called a PD-16. Anybody knows anything about photography probably don't even know what it is, but it was a little box camera. You'd pull out the lens on it. It took good pictures. I don't imagine maybe today it even take good pictures, but I had that, and I took the pictures and would, you know, get them developed and send them home. And my sister put everything that I sent home into an album. And like you say, when they went overseas, they told us we couldn't have a camera. And it probably only cost a couple of bucks or something like that. I said, well, what the heck? They take it away from me? They take it away from me. So I just stuck it in my backpack. And when I got there, they didn't say anything about her. And I had film, and I took pictures. But when we were in Africa, it was so hot, and there was no place to get the film developed, and I couldn't send it home, and, you know, all this like this. And I lost practically all my pictures in Africa I lost.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have a remarkable collection, and Had you started taking photographs long before you went into the service?
Oh, yeah, but I mean, it was just mainly family pictures and stuff like that. I mean, you record where you went and everything, yeah.
Well, I think it takes a lot of moxie to be taking photographs during combat.
Well, like I said, you'd be surprised that sometimes, you know, that explosion would be going all around you, and here you are taking a picture. But I was lucky on kind of my squad. We had like a 2.5-ton truck. All everybody rode on that truck wherever we went, and I had the camera with me all the time. And where most people, you couldn't do that. I was lucky that I had some place to put the camera. And, you know, and it would be around because I just can't see anybody else. Now, I understand that. Now, I had a friend that was in the division that was a photographer, and he did all the division photography. So he's the one that developed my pictures and everything for me. Mm-hmm. So really, really and truly in the long run, if it had been for him, I wouldn't have had any of these. And other than picking up postcards as I went along, mm-hmm. Also made the albums complete also.
Well, that's another remarkable inclusion in this album, is that you also would find, as you are traveling and in combat, that you would find these postcards and that they would be included in the album, and to make it such a complete document. I mean, it's quite remarkable.
Well,
I understand that you also had a diary or a journal that you were keeping.
Well, I kept that was against the rules too, but I also, I mean, whatever I could scribble a little bit of piece on a paper, I would put it on a little piece of paper and just I never sent it home. I kept it all with me all the time that I had, and because my son John tried to decipher it one time. And some of it was on onion skins, and it was just got all, you know, together and everything. Like he said, Dad, he said, I can't figure it. He said, you're going to have to tell me what this is all about so that, you know, that maybe we can get it down on a piece of paper. So,
what kinds of things would you record?
Well, just what happened from day to day. I just, mm-hmm. each day, I'd put down the day to day, or if we were bombed or shelled or where we moved to such and such a place or whatever we did. That's about all mm-hmm. was on there. Really and truly, it was, I should have never even had it, because if I'd have got captured or something like that and they'd got a hold of it, why, it might have been, you know, wrong intelligence for the mm-hmm. United States.
Mm-hmm. Well, I find these I haven't seen your diary, but I just find this truly amazing.
If you want to know, I have never seen a diary myself. It's my son had it, and I've never looked at it since. This has been what, 65 years, and I don't even know what it looks like. So I mean, there you are. I mean, but he had his secretary type a lot of it, mm-hmm. and some of it he had called me on the phone and asked me about such and such a thing. You know what it was, and I would explain to him and. So, but it's still not complete, though, because as it got down near the end of the war, because, you know, a lot of it was just scribbles and, you know.
Mm-hmm. Would this be something, I mean, you were creating words and also photographs. Was this also helpful to you in progressing through the war?
Oh, I can't say that it did. I can't say it didn't. I mean, when you're a young kid, you don't think about that. That's mm-hmm. all there is to it. You worry about day to day and let it go at that. I mean, you really don't. Of all the shelling and everything goes along and the death, a lot of times you just have to put it aside and just forget it. That's it. Because I lost a lot of good friends I lost my best friend on Anzio, and it bothered me for quite a while, but then after a while you just get over it, and that's all there is to it. You have to. Yeah.
Should we talk about Africa, North Africa again? Because you were in Operation Torch, which was the Allied invasion of North Africa, and your group came directly from the United States to North Africa.
That's
and
right.
Landed uh-huh. on the western coast. The date was
November 8th, 1942. Mm-hmm. I'll always remember. On account of, we really and truly, there was not supposed to be any opposition. We were supposed to just go right on in, even, you know, go to the docks, get off the docks and move in. But it didn't turn out that way. I mean, they were supposed to be making I don't know what you'd call with the Free French, in other words, to say that what was going to happen or anything, whether we were going to fight or what. And at the last minute, bingo, the negotiations broke down, and bingo, there we were. We were on our way into shore and in these little O'Higgins boats that I was telling you about. Mm-hmm. And when they had an electric light that shone way up in the air, and you could see that searchlight way up there. Oh, all of a sudden, when that searchlight came down, holy crime, and the battleships opened up, and that whole beach just went up, and you could just see the stuff just flying sky high, and they leveled the whole beach in there. But the soldiers in there were nothing but French Cingalese. We had very, very few French soldiers. Most of the French soldiers that were there were officers. The rest of them were all Cingalese, all soldiers.
Now, what time of day was this battle? Was it in the early morning or was it
early
night?
Morning, real early in the morning.
Okay.
Yeah, really. It was dark when we were going in, and it was still pitch dark, and it was just barely starting to turn daylight when we were pretty near hit the beaches then.
Yeah, and I'm sorry, the location was. What was the...
Fadela, right. North Africa, yep.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And how long did the battle last then that day?
About 3 days, that's about all. And really and truly, it didn't... it was just more or less, the infantry just more or less was cleaning up different spots around. And the invasion did take, I would say by mid-afternoon, most everything was all taken care of. But we lost more men than the boats turning over than we lost, by gunfire.
So the Higgins boats did not work well in that water?
It was too big. The waves were too big. The waves were just monstrous waves, and you'd get those Higgins boats sideways, and they would just roll over. That was all it was to it. I mean,
how many men do you think were lost at that
gosh,
time?
Gosh, honey, I have no idea, but we lost a lot, a lot of soldiers. I mean, and also a German Wolfpack come in at night. After the morning, that night, a German Wolfpack of submarines come in, and they sank five of our ships. You could just see them blazing out there in the water. I lost everything I had because the ship the name of the Tasker H. Bliss was the name of the ship that we went over on, and that mm-hmm. sunk. Mm-hmm. And I lost everything I had. The only thing I had on was, like I say, my all pack, and that was it.
Mm-hmm. And fortunately, your camera.
Yeah, well, my camera was in it with me.
So that battle, what happened then after landing and going through that experience? Where did you head next?
From there, we went to, I think it was Port Lioti, which was, maybe it was Rabat. I can't remember which. We either went to Rabat and then Port Lioti, or we went to Port Lioti and then to Rabat, one or the other. Farther up into Africa that's about the only two towns that I can really remember was Port Lioti and Rabat.
Now, did the fighting continue, or did you?
No, we didn't have any. And once that was there, I think I told you about that when we were in Fadela, we had to march into Casablanca. and President Roosevelt was sitting in his Jeep there as we marched into mm-hmm. Casablanca, and he was reviewing the troops when we went by. Mm-hmm. And that, like I said, it was really, I mean, the fighting was all over. There was no fighting at all. In fact, we never got into any fighting at all other than, like I said, I told you about the time. That was no fighting. We just went up as observers to see what was going on so that, you know, that we would know a little bit more to tell our men what to do and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. In Kasserine Pass, we were only there about 4 days. Mm-hmm. And we really weren't, we were close to see some of the, you know, what was going on, but we were never really in what you'd call in danger. That was all. I mean, we were... You can be close enough and still not be in danger.
So that, when you landed, that was your first experience of combat.
Right, as the Kasserine Pass was, yeah. Uh-huh, yep.
How long, then, did you spend in North Africa?
Oh, gosh, honey, I can't remember. If I knew the date that we went into Sicily... Because, in other words, we were outside of Bizerte because they bombed the port of Bizerte, the Germans did, quite often. Because we were about, 25 miles from Bizerte in a bivouac area. And we could see the searchlights and stuff at night up there, and you could see the ACAC going up and breaking, and you could hear the bombs falling and everything. But it was a long way from us. I mean, but when we left, that was, they cleaned everything out. You know, of course, Africa had fallen by that time. And because we left from the port of Bizerte to go to Sicily then.
So the amphibious training that you had then was used for the landing at Thalia.
The amphibious training we had was for the amphibious there at North Africa, and that was all. The only other time we used it was they had a C company of our outfit use an amphibious landing on Sicily and went around behind the Germans there and to try to trap some of them and cut them off. And that was, and then on Anzio we had landing, mm-hmm. and in southern France we had landing, but it was altogether different type of. The bad part was the Higgins boats in Africa. Mm-hmm. Rather than that, I mean, when we landed in Sicily, we had what we'd called LCIs, which was a bigger ship, and you'd go down the gangplank and, mm-hmm. you know, and go off and go in. And then the others had the landing, the transports, which are great, you know, had the great big door on the front, and bingo, they would flop mm-hmm. down, and you had your vehicles and everything else to take off and go in. So it was altogether different tactics mm-hmm. from then on, that was all.
Now, the Higgins boats, would you go over the sides of those
yeah,
boats?
Yeah, you had mm-hmm. to crawl over the side of them. I mean, yeah, you just go over the side of them, that was mm-hmm. all. They were a small boat. I mean, I think it looked to me like with some of these bass boats that run around. they were bigger than that, but, I mean, that's about the way they were. You mean, they just had sides on it.
Yeah. Now, how were you transported then from North Africa to Sicily? Because then you were involved in Operation Husky, which is the invasion of Sicily.
Yes. Well, we had what called LCIs. They were a bigger boat, mm-hmm. and when you'd hit, they had like on each side of the boat, they had like a landing strip, you know, I mean, a walk mm-hmm. thing that went down like that, and you'd go down the gangplank on either side of it, and they got in close to shore, and that's the way you went down on those.
So those were used as transports in the Mediterranean then to take you to Sicily.
Yeah.
How long a trip is it then from North Africa through the...
I can't tell you.
Okay.
Maybe if I'd have looked at my diary or something went back that, I probably could have told you what went on at different times. But, I mean, other than that, why... If it's a shame that maybe someday I'll get up enough nerve to read that. I guess I'm an oddball on account of some things I don't mind talking about, but others I just can't. Now, to go to Europe, don't want any part of it. There's no way that you can get me to go to Europe, mm-hmm. that's all. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'd rather see United States first. Mm-hmm. But I mean, that diary, I don't know whether I'm scared of it or what it is, but I've never looked at it. Mm-hmm. Never. It's from the time I come home. It's in a folder, you know, like I say, with mm-hmm. pages and stuff on it, but I've never seen it.
Would you like to talk about the invasion of Sicily and the strategy there?
Well, no, there's another thing, too, that people don't know about. On the invasion of Sicily, the 101st Airborne was coming in for a parachute drop. We got the word that it was Germans dropping parachutes. And believe it or not, we shot up our own men coming in there on Sicily. I mean, it was a fiasco. That was all there was to it. That was mm-hmm. really, because there's a whole thing. You see, somebody just got something crossed, and they said that they were dropping German paratroopers in on us. When they did that, well, that was poor 101st lost an awful lot of men and planes by being shot down like mm-hmm. that.
When was it finally discovered that that was the case?
Well, it's kind of, we were away from the beach and in quite a, you know, inland, mm-hmm. even if it's daylight by the time they realized because there again, we hit the beach, it's in dark. I mean, it was always, it seemed like at nighttime when you'd go in there and confusion. You can't believe on an invasion how much confusion you could run into on count if everybody doesn't know where they're going to go, or somebody, maybe you'd run into a firefight or something like that, and some of those guys mm-hmm. get pinned down and you're supposed to be going over here to do this. And it's something else. So once you get in and get situated where you know where each outfit is or what you got, so you know when to advance forward, why mm-hmm. this is all right. So, but we went from there into a town called Agrigento, and Sicily was all mountains. There was no flat lands hardly that I can remember. Other than going into some of the larger cities, mm-hmm. it would be flat. But other than that, practically everything was in the mountains.
It sounds like very difficult terrain.
It was real, real difficult terrain, yeah. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Because from Agrigento, we went to Palermo. We were, I can remember walking the streets of Palermo at night before anything was going on. I mean, that we were out patrolling, and I always get a laugh at when you see this Patton show that he showed him and his entourage and everything coming into Palermo. Well, that was about 3 days after we had already been to Palermo and moved out.
Your role at this point in time when you're in Sicily, are you following infantry?
Yeah. Wherever the 7th Infantry went, we went. I mean, if they needed us to go out and clean a mine, you know, say they got pinned down by a minefield or something like that, we'd have to go out in front of the infantry and pick up that minefield and clear it out. We wouldn't take the whole minefield. We would clear a path through for them. See, in other words, cleaning up a whole big minefield is too much. Mm-hmm. But all you had to do, we have what was called tracing tape. It was a white tape, and we'd mark a picket on each side, and we'd clean that part right there, right through that part, and then somebody else, another engineer outfit behind us, would come in and pick up the rest of the minefield then. Mm-hmm. The, But we were always out in front, let's put it that way. I mean, anything that had to be done, like heavy bridges that had to be built, another engineer outfit, a big engineer outfit, would build the bridges and stuff behind us. But whatever we did, we were in front.
So the enemy would be here, and your backup would be here, and you were kind of in the middle?
Well, I could say we were practically always, we had quite a few days of infantry right along with the 7th mm-hmm. Infantry. I mean, if you get pinned down, why, and anybody goes fighting service, that's all there is to it, yeah.
So you are truly on the front line.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't know how many days that we really had. The infantry, they got combat pay. Here we were a lot of times out in front of them, and we didn't get combat pay. I mean, that I could never understand that. I mean, on count of, we were infantry a lot of different times, mm-hmm. that when the infantry would have too much scattered out, they would throw us into that hole right there as infantry to fill in, mm-hmm. but we never did get combat pay, mm-hmm. you know? I could never really understand that.
How do you?
But I can understand infantry getting combat pay because infantry was infantry. That was always to it. I wouldn't want to be an infantry soldier.
How do you defuse these landmines that you're working with?
That what?
How do you defuse the landmine?
Well, it's hard. There's so many different kinds of landmines that they're just you'd have what we'd call a bouncing Betty. It would be about that big around and about that tall, and they would set them in, and they'd have like three prongs that are sticking up out of the ground. And if you hit any one of those three prongs, bingo, it would bounce right out and explode. Mm-hmm. But then you'd have a teller mine was a big tank mine. It was about that big around and about that deep. And you'd have to, once you'd come in contact with them, you'd have to take your bayonet and poke around till you found them, and then you'd have to poke all the way clean all the way around to make sure there's no what you'd call trip wires to lead to a booby trap. And a lot of times we did this at night too, and that's pretty tedious when you start picking up mines at nighttime. Daytime wasn't so bad because you could see what you're doing, but at night you really had to be careful.
I mean, I don't understand how you could possibly see at nighttime.
You feel. That's all you do. You'd take your hand and if you'd come to a wire, you'd stop. That was all there was to it. And you'd figure out where in the heck that wire went and everything. And if it was something that you couldn't handle, you would put a flag in there and back off, mm-hmm. and so somebody would know exactly where that mine was. Mm-hmm. See.
Now, are you always in danger while you're fooling around with
these gosh,
wires
yes,
being
yes,
blown
yes.
up?
We had a number of guys that were blown up by mines that accidentally mm-hmm. tripped them, you know. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times, you know, you walk in there and they always told you that if you hear that pop underneath your foot, to boom, fall flat immediately on count. That thing would bounce up out of the ground, and then it would spread an area. And if you're right underneath it, you had less chance of getting hit on count. That's going to spread out mm-hmm. over an area then.
Now, were these mines laid by the Germans or
Germans,
Italians?
Germans, yeah. Oh, yeah. Germans mm-hmm. and Italians, yeah. Uh-huh.
And as you progressed through the war, did the mines change at all? Did they?
Oh, yeah. There was a number of different, different kind of mines throughout the whole area. I mean, like I said, the same way with us. We had different mines, too. I mean, most of our mines that we laid a lot of times were just a small box mine about this big around that, you know, that you would lay a pattern. And you always, whenever you laid a minefield, you always made a pattern of that minefield so you know exactly when it comes into for you to pick it up, mm-hmm. then you'd know where, and if any of them were booby-trapped, you had that marked specifically on the map, so that you know that that's a booby trap mine. Mm-hmm. But that's what a lot of our kids got blown up by is by accidentally tripping a, a booby trap mine. It's maybe this guy over here would be picking up that mine, and somebody over here would get blown up. See, on kind of once they'd hit the wrong trip wire that's going across, and it would set off another mine someplace else. You know, it's kind of hazardous.
How did you feel? Because it would seem to me that you are always in a very hazardous position because you're involved in these mind.
Well, like I say, I mean that most of our guys were all very, very conscientious. I know one night I went to get one of our men called Malcolm Munwall. I'll always remember his name. And I went to get him to go out, you know, all he was going out on guard duty. And anyhow, I threw back his tarp, because on Anza we're dug in all the time, but I threw back his tarp and I said, "Malcolm, time to go on guard." He was down there saying the rosary on his hands and knees. And I just put the tarp back, went to the officer, and I told him, "Get rid of Malcolm." That was all it was to it. On account of, he would be a detriment to us. That's all there was to it. I mean, if anybody that was just the least bit scared, once you got scared, you were gone. I mean, in other words, they put you doing something else or shipped you back someplace else. That was all with them.
How can you not be scared?
Well, I guess you can always be scared. That's all. Many a time I cried. And I'm not kidding you. I was so scared when in invasion of Anzio, when we got in on Anzio, there was nothing, no fighting, no nothing. About the second day, when they started coming, oh God, they just bombed the living daylight out of us, and just bombs are falling every heck. I got knocked down twice, you know, the same night, and you talk. I was scared. Another kid and I, believe it or not, we ran down to the beach. There was a big pillbox down on the beach, and we knew that this pillbox was there. And these bombs are coming, and so we beat it down there. We figured, well, that's a pretty good safe place to be, is in that pillbox. It was strong and everything, and we crawled in that pillbox, and we held one another, and both of us was crying. Now, that's hard to say for two grown men to be crying like, but we were both scared to death. That was all there was to it. We were really scared. Joe Waters is his name. In fact, he came from the town that I was born in, Villa Grove, Illinois.
Did you see him?
After the war. He was up in Wisconsin, and we've had our Army reunions. We've had one every year. Next year will be our last reunion. We've had it for 62 years. Mm-hmm. And he's dead now, but I mean that he died quite some time ago. But I used to see him all the time. Yeah. Every year. He'd attend the reunion, and I'd get to see him.
We're going to stop here, and we will continue. And I wanted to pick up your album and have Henry... The camera is taking photographs of, or I should say filming, Mr. Charles Brun's album. This is album 4 of 4 albums. The album size is approximately 14 1/4 by 11, and these 2 pages represent a sample of the types of photographs and postcards that are found in the album. On the left are postcards that are picked up from Italy. On the right are photographs that Mr. Bruns took. The small photographs show the size of the PD-15 camera film, which is approximately 1 7/8 by 2 1/2. And then the larger photographs are enlargements of that size photograph. Also, you can see the beautiful cursive handwriting of Mr. Brun's sister, who labeled all of these photographs and put them into this album. This is a continuation of an interview for the Veterans History Project with Charles Francis Chick Bruns of Champaign, Illinois. Charles Bruns was a combat engineer with the Army's Company A, 10th Engineer Battalion, 3rd Infantry Division. His rank was sergeant. He joined the military in 1941 and was in combat from November 1942 to the end of the war in August 1945. Mr. Bruns was awarded the Purple Heart, the Good Conduct Medal, the Croix de Guerre, and several other citations and medals. In the first interview on September 24th, Mr. Bruns described his combat engineer training at several U.S. bases, his part in the invasion of North Africa and the Sicily campaign. He also described the diary that he kept, the collection of postcards that he collected, and the photographs that he took during training and service. He had begun talking about his combat experiences in Italy when the interview ended. Today is Friday, October 5th, 2007. My name is Harriet Williamson. Also present is Henry Radcliffe, who is the Director of Lighting, Sound, and Recording. We are in the television studio of WILL in Urbana, Illinois, on the University of Illinois campus. Mr. Bruns, one of the things I wanted to ask you about is you had a photograph where you were building a road in Sicily. And when we looked at that photograph, you had mentioned that Ernie Pyle had been in contact with your unit for a few days. Would you like to talk about that at all?
Well, that was it wasn't a road like. It was the Germans. It was a mountain pass through the mountain. And the Germans, instead of blowing up the whole mountainside or bringing down the river, they blew out the far side of the tunnel, on which went out into the Mediterranean Sea, and that just it just sheared everything all off the backside, and we had to build a road from the backside of that around to the land on the other side of the mountain, and we only had just I think they was finished in less than 2 days, where we got the first jeep across then to get supplies and stuff on up for to the infantry. But Ernie Pyle, he spent about 3 days with us while we were there at that site.
Now, did he write about your unit?
He wrote about the he called it the Island in the Sky. I think it was in Life magazine. If anybody ever had old Life magazines from 1943, I'm sure that it would, in the Battle of Sicily, it was in the Battle of Sicily, because my sister, I had seen the magazine, my sister had it when I came home, and I could see my picture in it very clearly, working on that road.
Is there anything else you would like to talk about regarding Sicily and that operation?
Well, I would say this, though, that for a comic thing of it, after the Sicilian campaign was over with, and anyhow, I had to go in a water detail, and we went down to Messina, and they talk about Patton being the first troop, or being in Messina. He didn't come in until quite a few days afterwards for the crowd and everything, but we were there, and they were shelling us from Italy. And anyhow, we had us pinned down behind a building, and one of our guys, which is naturally went out around scouting around, and come into a blown-out building, and bound in the bottom of that was the bottom of a brewery. So anyhow, we had our water cans, and we filled the water cans out of a great big spigot and put beer in them. Well, by the time we got back to the outfit, those cans, the beer was flatter than a pancake, wasn't any good at all. So we had to go get water again.
When you had talked about North Africa, you had mentioned that the German guns really were better than the American.
Oh, by far. There was no comparison between the German guns and our guns. In other words, even like when we went in Africa on the invasion, that's probably the reason why we didn't advance too far, because our equipment was so far... the Germans were so far superior to our guns and everything. It was absolutely ridiculous.
When did that, or did it not, change in terms of American armament versus German?
Well, it didn't. For it took Well, clear up into the invasion of Sicily before we had better equipment. And, well, pretty much everything was better by the time we on the invasion. And each year as we progressed, or, you know, over the years, by the time the end of the war, we had our equipment was just not, it was either just as good or better than the Germans. But they really had good equipment.
Now, speaking of equipment, you wanted to talk about the truck that was...
Well, I think you asked me one time, I couldn't understand, in the engineer, in a company of engineers, each squad had their own truck. And on our truck, we carried all of our mine detectors, all of our mines, any kind of road, you know, picks, shovels, anything for road construction, TNT for blasting. But everything we had on our truck. And wherever we went, it went with us.
Was that very dangerous to be with that truck since...
Well, it could have been if you'd got hit, you know, because it would take a direct hit from an artillery shell to explode everything in there on account of the mines and everything. You had to set those off. Same way the TNT, they had to be set off with a primer cap. And to be, you know, explosive. So it really wasn't that dangerous. I can tell you a story. You talked about Anzio. We had a bridge on Anzio, and all the pillars all the way around the bridge, we had a case of TNT setting on each pillar all the way around. And then we had that all wrapped with primacord, and then the caps were just sitting there loose. So in other words, if we had to blow the bridge of the Germans' counterattack, we had to blow that bridge, all we had to do is stick that cap into a block of TNT and blow the whole bridge. Well, the Germans would come in at night and would shell us with tanks. Well, we'd crawl up underneath that bridge, completely back underneath the abutment part of it, and the shells, the shrapnel and stuff couldn't hit us, but if they would have hit one of those boxes of TNT, we'd have probably all went up.
Would you like to talk some more about Anzio a bit?
Well, there's. Do you want me to tell you a story about in Champaign here? A lot of these people know Michael Kinigo. Michael Kinigo was editor he was married to Mrs. Kinigo. And we used to have a gentleman who would come by, ever so often. And I'd talk to him on the bridge there, never paid any attention to him, who he was. He'd go on through our lines. He'd be gone for a few days. He'd come back. He'd give me the password when he'd come back, and we'd talk, and he'd go on back. Well, after the war was over, I worked for the News Gazette, and I happened to be up in his office one day, and here was a great big bunker, sandbag bunker that we built on Anzio for the general. And I happened to see that there, and there he was standing alongside General Truscott. And I asked him about that, and he got talking, and here it turned out that he was a gentleman that was going through our lines, and I didn't even know anything about it.
Goodness. Were there any other people in your unit who came from Champaign-Urbana or from...
None in my outfit. My brother-in-law was in the 1st Special Service Force. That was a Canadian-American outfit. That's the one that lost... out of the whole battalion, I think they lost more than three-quarters of their battalion on account of the Germans counterattacked it and caught them flat-footed and either captured them or killed them. But he was in the 1st Special Service. He was the only... I did get to see him a couple of times when we were on Anzio, but that was about it.
Now, the British and the New Zealanders, and there were many other troops from South Africa and India who were in Italy, did you ever have contact with any of those troops?
Unless they were fighting along the side of us, I would say no. I mean, the only other troops I could think of was the 442nd, the Japanese outfit. They were fought along the side of us for a while up when we were going up through southern France on up into Germany. They were as a special unit at one time, but that's the only time I can think of any other special outfits other than the 36 in the 48th Division, they were right along the side of us most all the time.
I'm losing my train of thought here. Is there anything else that you would like to talk about in terms of the fighting at Monte Cassino or Anzio? I understand that that was some of the fiercest fighting in World War II.
Like Anzio was people just don't understand Anzio. When we hit the beaches there and everything was quiet for a few days until the Germans started counterattacking. And once they started counterattacking, well, they threw everything under the sun at us to get us off the beach. And that went on for, not quite 2 weeks. And then they just more or less, they couldn't shove us off. They didn't do anything, so they slacked. Well, then the Navy brought in smoke pots. And the smoke pots from the Mediterranean Sea carried the smoke back to the mountains. You couldn't even see the mountains anymore. So in other words, the Germans could not see us, and we couldn't see the Germans on account of the mountains was completely covered with smoke. And in the daytime on Anzio, you could get out and walk around. We played ball. We did everything in daytime, but nighttime it was a different thing. I mean, that usually that if the infantry called for us to go up and pick up a minefield, we had to go up and pick up a minefield. Or if we had to go lay a minefield, we had to go lay a minefield. It was always done at night, never in the daytime.
Mm-hmm. After Anzio, what was your next?
Ma'am?
Where did you go after Anzio?
After Anzio, well, we went into Rome. We was in, I got wounded in, going into Rome. But anyhow, I was in the hospital, and I got up out of the hospital because I didn't want to miss out. And my folks got a telegram that I was wounded in action, and they got a telegram that I was missing in action. And I kept writing them letters so they were really confused. They didn't know what was going on. But anyhow, I got into Rome on the, they went into Rome on the 4th of June, and the D-Day was the 6th of June. And I was going into the Rome to, I hitchhiked back to try to find my outfit on the 6th, that's the day that I got back into Rome, was the 6th day of June, because everybody was talking about the invasion of Europe at that time.
When you wrote back to your family, what kinds of things would you write to them?
Well, like any other young kid, you're having a great time and nothing was happening. I mean, you were very, you were safe and all that, but it wasn't quite that way.
Did you receive frequent letters from home?
Yes, I received quite a few letters from home, and I wrote home quite a few letters. My sister kept most of them. Whatever happened to all of them after I got home? I had seen them. They had them in a big box, but after we moved, I don't know whatever happened to them.
Did you want to talk any further about your experiences in Italy, either the river, the Volturno River, or Monte Cassino?
Well, honey, I really don't know what would you... we had quite a different crossing. The Volturno River in Italy was we had to put a pontoon bridge across for the infantry to get across, and that was a pretty harrowing experience. I mean, the Germans really didn't want us to come over the river, and so naturally they were always shelling us, and we still kept right on working and got the bridge across so they could get across.
What do you think is your most important memory of Italy?
What would be my most important?
Mm-hmm.
Gee, that's tough. That I come out alive, let's put it that way.
One of the photographs that you showed me that struck me was... actually, there were two photographs, one very poignant, which was the photograph of your best friend who had been killed. Was it at Anzio?
I didn't hear you again, honey.
The photograph, was it the photograph of your best friend, and was that at Anzio? Was he killed at Anzio?
Yeah, well, my really best friend that I was with service all the way through from Fort Leonard Wood, well, not Fort Leonard Wood, but Fort Lewis, Washington, from then on, all the way through the war, clear up through Anzio, he was killed on Anzio. Mm-hmm. And anytime, like I say, we'd go out at night and have to work, we'd come back and we'd get in our bunk or something like that, or sleeping quarters, and we always saved a little tiny piece of candle, and we'd light that little candle. Sometimes we in a you know, like a little shed like, and under the ground, and everything had would have earth over the top of it, so it was just like a little room like, and we'd play chess, and we had a chess board that was it folded up, but the pegs fit in tight, so in other words, that we could just move it from day. It might take us a week to play a game of chess. Mm-hmm. So we always had that chess there, but he was killed on Anzio, and well, I think I showed you a picture of his grave that mm-hmm. I took mm-hmm. on Anzio there.
Another photograph that you showed me was a picture of Mark Clark.
Well, Mark Clark, he visited our, well, he was coming to our bivouac area just checking up, I suppose. He'd come to command office, and he was there just a short while. Another time when we were on Anzio, that was in Italy when Mark, he came to visit us one time when we were on Anzio, and the funny part was about, three weeks later, we got the Stars and Stripes, and in the Stars and Stripes it said that he just barely missed being killed. Well, it was about, he had left our area about, half hour, and our whole area was just shelled like I don't know what. So that's as close as he came. He had been gone about a half hour.
The Stars and Stripes, now that's the military.
That was a military newspaper. Uh-huh.
How often would you receive that?
Gosh, honey, I really and truly don't remember how often we'd get that. It would be it'd be ever so often.
Would
everybody
be?
Was tickled to death to get to see it, because...
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, a lot of people, I think Bill Maldwin was in our 3rd Division. And, he was, his cartoons are really something else. I mean, if you ever get a chance to look at one of his books on Joe and Willie, why, it's quite something to see.
I have seen them, but I think you have to be a combat veteran to really appreciate them and understand them.
I mean, you'd have to, in other words, to somebody that's in combat would really understand, mm-hmm. you know, what they're all about.
Mm-hmm. During the time that you were in combat, did you always know where you were and what the plan was, or was there a lot of chaos and confusion?
No, not really. I mean, in other words, then whatever you were going to do, the officers would come and tell you that, you know, in other words, it's, if the whole platoon was going to move out or do, you know, work on something, or whether your squad had to go do one job or something like that. I mean, you know, a lot of people get to misinterpret, like when the infantry had called for you to clean a minefield, you didn't completely clean that minefield. All you did was clean a path through that minefield so the infantry could go through it. And I mean, then another engineer outfit, you know, after you were through, another engineer outfit would come down and they would clean out the rest of that minefield.
Mm-hmm.
Same way in building bridges. We really, in combat, you only build temporary bridges. It was never a permanent bridge. Permanent bridge was built by a larger engineer outfit.
Mr. Brunsworth, the wound that you received, did that cause you any difficulties through your life?
Not really. All it did was tear up a little bit of my flesh and everything. And I mean, and I got a few scars from it, but that's about it.
When you left Italy, how did you proceed and where did you go next?
Well, next we went in, the invasion of at Salerno was already on, and we didn't come in until a couple of days after the invasion was already there. And the 36th and the 45th was already in there, and they were getting shoved out, and then we come in to bolster them up, and that's what held the beachhead then from then on, and then from then on we pushed forward.
Mm-hmm. And then when you left Italy, what was your next place that you went?
Well, in other words, through Italy, I mean, we got up to Monte Cassino. At Monte Cassino, they pulled us off the line. We took a little bit of invasion, more or less, practice on the boats. And then we got on the boats and went to Anzio, and that was it. And then from Anzio, we went to Rome. And we were supposed to garrison Rome then. At least that's what we were told. Well, we were there about 3 weeks in Rome. And then they pulled a division out. We went back to Naples again, and then from Naples, why we went to southern France.
Now, when you talked about practice on the boats, what kind of practice?
Well, there really wasn't a whole lot to do. I mean, then, you know, we landed on landing crafts, and they were big. I mean, it wasn't like the old days when beginning of the war, when we were in little small Higgins boats, mm-hmm. and we climbed down over the ship mm-hmm. to get into these Higgins boats, and you'd circle around and then you'd go in. But these, they just drove them right up, you know, close to the beach, and most generally you had all your equipment with you, your trucks, everything, and then you just rolled them off. The infantry was already, by the time we got there, we didn't go in the invasion like we did in Africa. In Africa, we had trained everybody. Would get into the Higgins boats and go in on then, and then your equipment would come in later. But after they had learned more what to do, and our invasions in was like invasion of Europe. They had big ships, and they just pulled them right up, you know, close to the beachhead and dropped the thing, and in you went.
What are some of the other things that the military learned in Africa that maybe was applied later in Italy or in France or Germany?
Well, I really can't say, because I mean each time that you went into any place, in other words, that. Well, it's kind of hard for me to explain, but I mean that most all the tactics that we had learned in the States, they weren't any good at all. I mean, we didn't even use them. I mean, once you got into the actual all combat, why they just, because they had us back in the States, they had us making, you know, barbed wire entanglements and digging trenches. Well, you dig trenches, all right, but all you dug was foxholes. You didn't dig trenches. But everybody, in other words, if you get pinned down someplace, why, and you were going to have to stay and more or less fight as infantry, why then you had to. Now the infantry, they dug foxholes all the time. I mean, if I wouldn't want to be in the infantry. Infantry was. It was something else. I felt sorry for those fellas because they went through an awful lot.
Well, going to France, was that by the landing craft?
Yes, that was landing craft there. I mean, in other words, we were on a, I can't name it, I don't even know the name of the, it was a good sized ship, but mm-hmm. they also had, we had all of our trucks and everything. We just drove off our trucks when we got to southern France. So,
now, when you reached France, was the combat that you saw there as heavy as it was in Italy?
Ma'am, I can't hear you again.
Was the combat in France as heavy as it was in Italy at Anzio?
Well, the infantry had a tough time of it. We didn't have a tough time on account of the infantry. It had already cleaned out everything and pushed ahead. By the mm-hmm. time we got there with our equipment and everything, well, the infantry had already... They had landed early that morning and had pushed ahead. But then they had got stopped just around the mountainside there. And by the time we got off, we got all of our equipment and everything off. We were all ready to go, but the infantry hadn't cleaned out the Germans up ahead, so we couldn't move, and there was nothing really for us to do. I mean, other than wait for them to, if they'd called on us, then we had to go up and go to work. But they never did call for us to do anything right off, you know, right at the landing part.
Now, you landed in, was it Toulouse?
Ma'am?
Where did you land in France?
I was trying to think. I was trying to think. It's the name of the town, and it's.
Do you remember where you proceeded from there?
Well, we went up. We was in the southern part, is below Marseille. I know that. But because we went up along the coast, along Switzerland, and up through France, up through that way, up into Germany. But we were close to Switzerland, all the way up the coast through Nantes. I can't think of the name of some of the other towns that we were in.
At some point in time, did you cross the Siegfried Line?
Oh, yes. That was beyond Nantes when we was there. But let me tell you a story on the Siegfried Line, though. Most generally, you can't believe that we had to blow up what's it called, the dragon's teeth, to get the tanks, you know, through. And they were big concrete bunkers. I mean, that they were shaped like a triangle. And there was about, I would say maybe, 6-7 rows of those things. All they were there was to stop the tanks. But all we had to do was dig down low and stick a TNT underneath them and then blow them up. And we'd get them loose, and then we'd take a bulldozer and bulldoze them out of the way and make a path through there so they could get the equipment through.
It sounds like a lot of work.
Well, it was. I mean, because we had our big bulldozers. We had a light bulldozer and then a medium bulldozer, and then we had a great big heavy bulldozer, and it took the heavy bulldozers to doze those out of the way. Because, you know, a lot of times when you're, like I say, in engineers, we had all this stuff to do, our equipment with us. So in other words, that we had compressors and the dozers. And then the doze operator, I mean, in building roads and everything, it was just like a regular, you know, I mean, it was regular construction is what you do. Mm-hmm. But the squads, more or less, would do the menial work. But if you needed big, heavy work, then we had the big, heavy work. And that was the same way on those, going through the dragon's teeth, that the big bulldozers was upend those concretes to build. Now all they did was make a road wide enough just to get through. That's it.
Did you ever have any problems with the weather and having your equipment getting bogged down?
Oh, guys. I mean, if anybody was at Monte Cassino, the mud, it rained all the time, and the mud was just knee-deep. I mean, that you just sloshed around in mud. Mm-hmm. So many people come down with trench foot. Luckily that we had those kind of rubberized boots back in those times, too, and that helped quite a bit, you know, getting your feet all slug. But if you just had shoes on, you had nothing but wet feet. That was all there was to it, because it rained. It was just nothing but just mud. You'd get up there on that mountainside, and it would just rain. I had the mountainside there one day, why my aunt had sent me a cake from home. It was a fruit cake. And it took a long, long time, I guess, for that fruitcake to get me. But by the time it got to me and we opened that, there was about 6 of us. And we opened that fruitcake, and it was just full of mold. It was just all the fruit in there. We ate that cake just like it was going out of style.
Do you feel that the soldiers were well-equipped in terms of the uniforms that they had and in order to maintain their health during rain and cold?
Well, it was, we had our overcoats, we had our slickers, if you didn't get wet all the way through, you were fine. I mean, now, like I say, wintertime come along, and there for a while, we didn't have heavy enough equipment to battle them, but we got equipment later on. I mean, as we was going up through Germany, we ran into a lot of snow in Germany, and we got boots. We had our equipment was pretty good. I mean, it was cold. You were plenty cold. I mean, but if you didn't get wet, you were fine.
Mm-hmm. Now we're approaching the end of the war, and you were in Germany. How did that proceed? Your transit through Germany.
Well, I didn't understand again.
When you reached Germany and you crossed the Siegfried Line, what happened after that in terms of your experience?
Well, I just can't, to be honest with you, I can't remember. If I knew exactly where we were going at that, I could probably tell you. But I mean, in other words, that the only thing I can tell you that we just, once we broke through the Siegfried Line, we would move rapidly, miles at a time. I mean, in other words, that sometimes we'd go maybe 15 or 20 miles before you'd ever stop. Mm-hmm. And the infantry and the tanks and everything, they would just move along as fast as they could go. The only time that if they got held up someplace, why, we might be stuck for a day or so.
Did you have any contact with civilians in either France or in Germany?
Honey, I'm sorry, I can't.
Did you have contact with civilians in either France or Germany?
Oh, sure. I mean, like I said, in Italy they were the same. I mean, we had contact with them and everything. Some of them were nice and friendly, some of them weren't. Same way with France. I mean, they all treated you nice and everything when you were along. Really, even after we got into Germany, I couldn't, they used to tell us all these stories of what was going to happen to us and everything once we got to Germany. But I mean, there was nothing that I can see of. And one thing they told me about when we were going overseas, that there was no churches. We didn't have. I was a Catholic, and they said, "Shoot, first place I went to, we went to church, and there was no problem whatsoever. The only thing is that when they'd go to speak, I didn't understand what they were saying, but I could follow everything in a mass fine."
Mm-hmm. Do you think you were misled at all in terms of what the enemy was like, and you, that opinion changed or not?
Yeah, I think so. I think when we first went over there, we were then under the impression that it was, it was going to be quite ruthless. But it so happens the only one that was ruthless was the SS, and they were really ruthless. People do not understand what the SS was, and that was the German elite soldiers. And they were, the SS was even harder on their own soldiers.
Do you want to talk about that a little bit more?
Well, honey, I don't know what you want to say. In other words, we've come in contact with different places where the German officers, if the all Germans were retreating and the SS wanted them to stay in place, they would even shoot them to make them stay in place. Mm-hmm. And that to me, that was all wrong. So we never really... if we caught SS officers, they didn't last long. That was all there was to it. I mean, it's hard to say, but they were found somewhere along the line.
Now, some of your photographs have that were taken, that are in your collection, but were taken by an Army officer, are photographs from a concentration camp?
Well, that was in Dachau. We didn't liberate. I don't know what outfit liberated Dachau. I don't know, but we were close by Dachau. And anyhow, the commanding officer took three or four of us over there to see the prison camp. And he was the one that took the pictures. I didn't. Enlisted men weren't allowed to have a camera, but the officer could have a camera, and it showed You just can't believe the stench of the place, and they had piles and piles of clothes, piles of bodies. They even had with some of those pictures I showed you. They were burning them in a crematory. So I mean, people who say today that this didn't happen, they don't know what they're talking about.
Were other people in your unit able to witness this as well?
No. There's only just a few of us that got to go over to see Dachau. That was all. I mean, about the only soldiers that I know of that really saw Dachau was the outfit that liberated. And I don't know what outfit it was that liberated. Maybe you might read back somewhere along the line to see who did do it, but I don't even know what outfit even liberated them, because they weren't in our sector at all.
Did that affect you as you continued through the war?
Not really. I mean, it's a hard thing to say, but when you see death, you don't think too much about it. That's all there is to it. I mean, it's a hard thing to believe in.
Mm-hmm. I understand from your photographs that you also saw Hitler's eagle's nest.
Yes, I mean that was near the end of the war. We were in Birch's Garden, probably a day before the night before the British bombed it, and then we went into it was in the town of Birch's Garden. And Hitler's home was out quite a ways outside of Birch's Garden. And anyhow, the British bombed it that night, and we went in the next morning. Now, if you ever hear to see the show about the Band of Brothers said that they were the first ones into Birch's Garden. But history has proven that the 7th Infantry was the first ones into Birch's Garden, and we were, naturally, our engineer was with the 7th Infantry when he went in. And when I've got pictures of smoke coming out of Hitler's home, I've also got a tablecloth that was on one of his tables out on the veranda there. I mean, every now and then they'll show on a History Channel or something, show that his veranda out there, and they show this big table with an umbrella over it and everything. Well, this tablecloth fits right over that thing. I have that at home, and they had tunnels. And I was talking to somebody here not too long ago who said they were there, but there's no place in there where these tunnels are. But these tunnels went way down underneath the ground. They had piles and all different rooms were full of different kind of art, statues, anything of artifacts and everything was stored down there. And they had like a hospital, they had rooms, they had room after room of any kind of liquor that you wanted, wines. They had different rooms of different wines, champagne. But the only thing that was bad was the refrigeration was broken. Well, when we got down there, naturally, these rooms were sealed off, so you'd have to open a room, put a handkerchief over your mouth, run in, grab a couple of bottles of booze, and bring them back out. And you could only, so you would just take turns of each guy running in and grabbing something and bring them out and putting them in a bucket.
Now, what was the role of your group when you were there? What was your function there?
Well, there was really nothing. I mean, the infantry had already cleaned it all out and, you know, moved all through. We just happened to be there, and they had us go down and check it out, see if there's anything that, you know, that any demolition or anything, but there was nothing there to prove the demolition. And then when we got ready to leave, and this was still before the 101st got in there, the French brought in great big trucks, and they were hauling out all of this art that was down below, putting it on these trucks. And wherever they were taking it, I don't know, but they were taking all this art from down below in the caves, carrying it out and putting it on these trucks.
Fascinating.
So, I mean, in other words, that Oh, gosh, there was so much art down there that you can't believe. I mean, that famous art, because some of the guys, maybe, I don't know whether ours or outfitter did or who got them, but some of them, they caught up with later on that you weren't allowed to take that art.
Mm-hmm. When you left that part of Germany, where did you next head?
Let's see, from Berchtesgaden, we went to Salzburg then. We went back, and the war was practically over at that time, mm-hmm. when we moved back to Salzburg. I mean, and then we were supposed to garrison there for a while, which we only stayed maybe a couple, 3 weeks, and they moved us back on up into Germany for occupation duties. And at that time, they came to... there was, some of us had so many points that to go home that they flew us home. And I've been trying to talk to a number of people that everybody that I know of came home by boat, but I got to fly home. I mean, in fact, they took us from truck from, I can't even name the town we were in for occupation, but from there, we went down to Marseille, and they put us on B-17 bombers that were all cleaned out. All they had like a seat along each side, and they all the soldiers that were flying home. And then they flew from Marseille to Casablanca, and when he went to Casablanca, the pilot banked over the Fidela there where we had landed, and you could still see our equipment and stuff down on the beaches of there. And then we landed at Casablanca and refueled. From there, we went to the Azores and refueled. From Azores, we went to Newfoundland. From Newfoundland, we went into Boston. And from Boston, I caught the train home from there.
Now, when you came home, were you still involved in the military, or was that it?
Nope, that was it. When I got home, I was in the processing center for, I don't know, a couple of days is about all, and my brother-in-law picked me up and brought me home then.
Well, what is it like to go suddenly from being in the theater of operation, even though the war has ended, and all of a sudden, boom, you're back home?
Well, I don't know how to tell you this, but I mean, the only, really and truly, where we were, air base out here at WILL, I guess, the planes, would come every night as those planes come over. Boy, I woke up right now. I mean, it just scared the living daylights out of me, because it took me, I can't say how long it took me to get used to hearing that. I just wake up out of a dead sleep when I'd hear that airplane go over. And then you'd go back to sleep again. But I mean, it took me a long, long time before I ever got. Other than that, I don't think I was affected in any other way. But when I'd hear that airplane at night, it always affected me.
Do you still have visions or dreams of your experiences?
Not anymore. About the only time I hate to say as a grown man, but if I think of some of the, I go talking about it. Sometimes you give a talk to somebody or something like that, and I go talking about the different things that we were in, and some of my fellow servicemen that I, got killed. Sometimes I start to cry a little bit, but it's been a long time now since I've really talked about it, so I don't know whether I would cry anymore or not. I don't know.
Do you belong to any veterans groups or?
I'm a life member of the Disabled Veterans, and I'm a life member of the VAW 5520 here.
Have you participated in any reunions?
We haven't had a reunion. This next year, I'll be hosting our last reunion, I think, and that'll be our 62nd reunion. But every year, we've had a reunion of our battalion, and we've gone to all over the United States. Mm-hmm. Not every state we've been in, but we've been to most of them. And we've even been to Puerto Rico a couple of times. One of our friends, my friend, is I was in service with is from Puerto Rico, and he had us there a couple of times.
What are those reunions like for you?
Well, it's fun. I mean, years ago we had a lot of fun. Many years ago, we used to have them out on farms. Guys would bring their tents and trucks and stuff. You know, not trucks, but what am I trying to say? Not an RV, but trailer-like truck, or, you know, where you sleep in the trailer. And they would bring their families. We brought all the kids and everything, I mean, to these things. And we'd have, you know, they'd just have a great time. It most generally would be out on a farm. And later on, we started having in a hotel. And when we first started having them, they lasted just one day. Well, then they got to 2 days. Then later on, quite a few years after that, we ended up, it was like a week's vacation. In other words, the reunion was 3 days long. You paid so much for your food and drink and everything, each individual did, and pay your own room, naturally. But, I mean, you'd put so much in the kitty and that'd take care of everything. Well, now we're still down to where we have them 3 days a week, but most generally they just come for the 3 days and that's it. I mean, whereas before, why, we'd come maybe 1 or 2 days ahead and stay a couple of days after, so you make a vacation out of it. But now, why, it's just like Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, and you go home then.
How do you think this experience of being in World War II has affected your life?
Well, I really and truly, that's a hard question to answer. I really and truly do. I mean, it's hard. If you want to know my opinion, it's hard for me to think of these kids that are in service now, really. I mean, I feel sorry for them. I mean, because they're in combat. It's not like I don't think this is the same type of war that we were in. I mean, it's altogether, you know, really and truly. What people don't understand, though, when you go into these conflicts, you only got a few people that's doing the fighting. Rest of them are all supporters. So in other words, that all these people, you've got thousands of people in Iraq, but you've probably only got less than a third that's doing all the fighting. The rest of them are there as supporters.
Excuse me. Henry, did you want to ask a question? I'm sorry.
No, he was trying to think of something.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Camper or Jeep.
Okay.
Mr.
Burns, did you want to say anything else about that we haven't talked about during this interview? Is there any other comments that you would like to make?
Well, but the only thing I can do is try to answer questions, because I can't think of anything don't forget, that's been a long time ago since I was over there.
I want to thank you very, very much for talking.
Well, I appreciate you having me. I mean, I don't know whether I've helped you any or not, but I mean, it's a shame that I can't remember some of these dates, some of the things that really went on, but it's hard. If I could probably see them and know, you know, maybe if I'd figured out a way ahead of time or something like that, I might have been able to help you more.
Well,
but
you know, I don't think those things are in the greatest importance. I think that what you've expressed in this discussion is of great value to people and will be valued.
Well, it's a lot of people say it's hard to talk about. I understand that. But, I mean, I also understand that, I mean, that if somebody doesn't say something about it, you really don't truly know what's going on.
I would totally agree. Now, you told me that you had a chance to watch a lot of the Ken Burns series. What do you think of that series?
I thought it was wonderful. I've learned more of watching that show, and here I was in combat and everything going on, and I've learned more in that show of what really... See, all I know is what happened to me. Mm-hmm. You don't know what happened to all these other people, see? Mm-hmm. I mean, and where he has showed, you know, what has really gone on. All I told you about, I took my training with the 1st, 2nd, 3rd Marines to go to the South Pacific. I'm so tickled to death that I didn't go to the South Pacific that I don't know what to do. Because to me, that was really miserable over there. That was all because they were fighting a different type of person. That was all there was to it. Because in Germany, if they saw that they couldn't, they would give up. That was all there was to it. Where they didn't do that in Japan, they just didn't give up. Mm-hmm. But the prisoners in Germany were altogether different.
Were there any thoughts or emotions that came to your mind in watching that series?
About the only, I could never understand. They always talk about the Battle of the Bulge. Well, when the Battle of the Bulge was going on, we were down in the southern part, which was called the Comar Pocket. Mm-hmm. Now, history, I don't think that the history brings out too much about the Comar Pocket, but we were in the same situation that they were, except we weren't surrounded. Where in Bastogne, they were surrounded. But we had to retreat on account of, I can remember when we have to, you know, we were the last ones to come along, and we had to take a TNT and put blocks, you know, on a big tree. And it, boom, it snapped that tree off and fall that tree over the road. And we had to do all the demolition, blow up roads and everything, you know, as retreated. They always say that the United States doesn't retreat, but we retreated at that time.
Did you have to go back then?
Then we went back again. Mm-hmm. See, mm-hmm. I mean, after they stopped the Germans advancing, why, then we had to take that all back again and rebuilt everything that we tore up.
Again, thank you so very, very much. I really appreciate
it. I appreciate it. Okay, thank you very kindly.